Blog Talk Radio.
Spirit of Truth Ministry is delighted to bring you the Revelation of Jesus with Rick Sterling, where we test the beliefs of Christianity against the very words of Jesus that he gave his own eyewitness disciples. Join us for a unique and challenging study into truth, justice, and the kingdom of heaven. Good morning and welcome. Good evening, wherever you are. Good day. My name is Dennis Neufeld, and this is indeed the Revelation of Jesus with Rick Sterling, brought to you by Spirit of Truth Ministry. We are delighted that you've taken a few minutes out of your day to join us as we study to learn some things about the truth and about our relationship to it. Before we get started, I want to call your attention to our chat room. I have linked to websites there. The WordPress website is linked at spiritoftruthministry.net, and the original website is linked at spiritoftruthministry.net/STNM, where all three of those letters are in caps. We highly recommend that you go there, especially to the WordPress website, where you can read all sorts of good things, including our book, The Spirit of the Church, by Rick Sterling and me. If you also go there, you can sign up for our RSS feed, where when a new writing is posted, you'll get a message, and then you can go there and read it. Let's have prayer, and we will get started right now. Father in heaven, thank you for granting us a peaceful and a joyous time as we come aside on this Sabbath day to reflect and to study what it means to be your servants, your servant. And I pray, Father, that as we move forward with this study, that you will move forward with your timetable and bring us to the place where we can come home with you. And I thank you for this in the name of Jesus. Amen. Suzette, good morning.
Morning. Oh, good morning, Don and Linda. Glad you're with us.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
And?
Good morning to Roger.
Good job.
We're here in overcast Southern California.
Uh-huh. Well, then the sun's starting to peek through. Good morning, Larry. And, of course, good morning to you, Rick. It's nice to see everybody here. And reasonably healthy for a change. You're up.
Thank you, Dennis. And welcome to all of our listeners. I hope that what you hear will help you in your understanding and will help you to know where to start your search for your studying as you work to understand the information that God has been pleased to share with us. I want to say this, and this is very important. Not everything in the Bible is true. Everything that God said that is in the Bible is true. But not everything in the Bible is true. There are weeds, tares among the wheat. What does God want? What does he want from us who have chosen to learn from him, to listen to his voice and to learn from him? When God looks at this earth, he is looking for a specific character, a specific condition. And we find this at the conclusion of the Song of the Vineyard in Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 7. Yes, the vineyard of Yahweh Sabaoth is the house of Israel and the men of Judah, that chosen plant. He expected justice. So God's expectation, when he looks for this specific characteristic, is justice. But found bloodshed.
His expectation is based on people doing what he has asked them to do, based on obedience, is it not?
It is the answer to the question, what is taking God so long? Why does he sit back and watch the atrocities taking place on the face of this earth, and seemingly he is doing nothing about it? Hopefully by now you understand this very important point. When God returns to this earth, it is for one purpose: harvest. He's not coming to plant seed. He has already planted seed. 2,000 years ago, God planted seed. And after planting this seed, he left. And he left this world in the care of his servants. His servants were to tend to the seeds that he had planted. What the evil one did, and it was a stroke of genius, what the evil one did. The evil one planted seed shortly after the sower left to go to his home.
A word comes to mind for that action. It's found in Genesis, and I was exploring using it in the writing that I'm doing for an expanded illustration of something. The word is crafty.
Crafty is a good word. Crafty. The seed that the evil one, the devil, planted, when eaten, is a poisonous chemical in the seed that causes a condition similar to that of being slightly inebriated. So it dulls the senses. With the senses appropriately dulled, it is easy to follow the power of suggestion. If you prefer to consider yourself saved by grace, and not by anything that you do, because your good works are at best filthy rags, And as long as you continue to feast on the fruit of terrors, T-E-R-E-S, or T-A-E-R-E-S, how is it spelled?
Terrors.
Terrors.
T-A-R-E-S.
T-A-R-E-S, okay. Which is commonly believed to be that which is called Darnell, D-A-R-N-E-L. As long as the people are fed on the fruit of the Darnell, they are continually kept in a state of drunkenness. Not drunkenness to the point of passing out, but drunkenness to the point that it really doesn't matter.
That's drunkenness to the point of stupor or stupid.
So Yahweh Sabaoth looked at his chosen people and he expected justice. Now, why would he expect justice, and would his people know that God's expectation was justice? Now, justice for God is not so much in the punitive sense, but in the caring sense, that people care for their neighbor. They have they show generosity to widows and orphans. They treat their neighbor in a just manner. They don't take a part of his land. They don't steal from him. They act in a just manner. And another word for just or justice is righteous. So he looked for righteousness in the form of just actions. But what did he find? Bloodshed. He found bloodshed. The people were consuming one another, not literally, but spiritually. He looked and he expected integrity. That is a very important word. Everyone who acknowledges a belief in and service to Yahweh Sabaoth, the God who created everything, must always have in their heart and their mind integrity and act with integrity in everything that they do. He looked for integrity, but only found a cry of distress. Now, what does he mean by a cry of distress? Well, when things became quite uncomfortable for the children of Israel, then they would turn to their God, the God of their fathers. And they would plead, why am I in such misery here? Why, when I plant my fields, do my enemies come and steal all of my harvest? So it leaves me with nothing. Why? When you promised this wouldn't happen. Why do I have ill health when you promised this wouldn't happen? And this drought, why don't you send the rain like you promised? It just doesn't happen. Please, God, on my behalf. And God informs, when you perform your part of the covenant, I perform my part of the covenant. But you see, performance, just as it is today, is not anything that people want to do, that they prefer to do. They prefer to do nothing and be rewarded with everything. Isaiah chapter 42, I'm starting with verse 18. Listen, you deaf. That is, to me, somewhat of a contradiction. If you are deaf, how can you listen? Of course, we understand that God is speaking in the spiritual context. So, you can be physically deaf, and you can be physically blind, so that you cannot hear the spoken word and you cannot see the substances around you. If you are spiritually deaf, you can hear people speaking. You do not hear the voice of the Spirit speaking, so you are deaf to the Spirit. And blind. You can look around and see the real world around you, but you cannot see God. Who so blind as my servant, so deaf as the messenger I send? Anything there seem a little out of the ordinary? Yesterday, we talked about Moses, and we mentioned Jonah. I didn't talk about David or King Saul or a few others that I could have mentioned. Even Abraham, as great for God as he was, still had some quirks, if you will. Trust seems to be an elusive quality in God's chosen people. Few have exhibited the kind of trust that God really appreciates. Abraham, for example, when he went into Egypt, knew that his wife Sarah was very beautiful. And he knew that Pharaoh would want Sarah to add to his collection of wives and concubines. And that to add her to his harem, so to speak, he would kill her husband. And wanting to spare his life, he passed her off as his sister, which, of course, was kind of half true. She was his half sister. They had the same father, but different mothers. So he lied instead of trusted. Now you could say, well, God understands. That's how grace works. God understood why Abraham did what he did, and okay, so that's fine. It's probably not what he would have preferred, but Abraham loved him. But did Abraham trust him? Trust. Did Moses trust God? Well, there were two or three or more times where Moses chose to inform God of a seemingly rash or foolish choice. And God chose Saul to be the king, the first king. Now, I may have been some irony in there. I don't know, because God wanted Israel to recognize him as their king as well as their God. But the people wanted a human king. They wanted someone who would raise up an army and defend them. And why would they want this? Well, because the priests had not done their job. The people were not living according to the high standards that God had established for them, for their lives. And because of this, the Philistines had come in and were causing havoc among them. And other nations of people were coming in and pretty much having their way with them. And the Israelites were getting really tired of all of this. And instead of the priest saying, look, this is what you need to do, God had the judges, and the judges were telling the people what they needed to do, but the people weren't listening to the judges. They would only listen to the judges when it was to their benefit. And so the people wanted a king who would raise up an army to protect them, because they would rather take care of their own protection than to leave it up to God and live according to God's righteous standards. And how I see that happening today. Who is so blind as my envoy, so deaf as the servant of Yahweh? You have seen many things, but not observed them. That's verse 20, Isaiah 42. Your ears are open, but you do not hear. It is Yahweh's will for the sake of his integrity to make his law great and glorious. And what has Paul made of God's law?
Where there is no law, there is no violation.
So he has set the law aside. Oh, he's careful. He didn't do away with the law, but that would be too obvious. But he said what the law is there for is so we will know what sin is. The law defines sin. It sets the boundaries on sin so that all who look at the law will recognize that they are sinners. And God offers grace to pay for our sin so that he can save sinners. But I don't find that anywhere in that which is legitimately God's word. I don't find that anywhere.
Romans 4:15, for the law brings about wrath, but where there is no law, there also is no violation.
No, I think it's important to insert here what you said a couple weeks ago.
Speak up a little higher.
I think it's important to insert right here what you said about a week ago. If you stop and think about it, has God's universe ever been without law?
Stop and think about it.
Yeah.
There's never been a time. My voice is so bad.
His universe doesn't operate on grace, never has.
But there's always been law there.
It is Yahweh's will for the sake of his integrity to make his law great and glorious. How can you make his law great and glorious when you say it kills? Mm-hmm. And that is exactly what Paul says. The letter kills. but the Spirit gives life. But this is a people, this is verse 22, Isaiah 42. But this is a people all pillaged and plundered, trapped in caves, hidden in dungeons. They are looted with no one to rescue them. Robbed with no one to say, give it back. Which of you listened to this? Will pay attention and mark it against the time to come. Who handed Jacob over to the robber? Israel to the pillagers? Was it not Yahweh? We had sinned against him. We had refused to follow his ways or obey his law. On him he poured out the blaze of his anger and the furies of war. It enveloped him in flames, and he did not notice. It burned him up, and he gave it no thought. The Son of God came, and he chose 12 men. The 12 men he said that his father gave him. Why did he choose 12 men? Well, if you ask the experts, they would question whether he actually chose anybody at all. But he chose 12 men to teach them. One he knew would betray him. Not because he had been forced to do it, because he chose to do it. God's choice. And why did he need to choose anybody at all? Why couldn't he just go around in the country of Judea and Galilee, say what he needed to say, and hope that what he said in the presence of so many witnesses would ultimately be passed on down through each generation until it was in the generation that would be alive at the time of his return. I just read a short excerpt from an article explaining or introducing a book that Bart D. Ehrman has written. This book seriously and, let's say, academically challenges the information that has been written down that we find in the Bible, specifically in the New Testament, quote-unquote, Gospels. His conclusion is that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John never existed. That what we have written under each name was an oral transmission from what Jesus said. And that what he said was passed around from father to son, daughter, mother, and on down the line, generation after generation, until some people decided that they would write it down, what they heard. And of course, those of us who have played the game gossip, where you have a line of, oh, I don't know, 10, 20 people, and the first person makes a statement to the person sitting next to them in their ear, they whisper so that no one else can hear except the person they're whispering to, and that person whispers what they heard to the next one and on down the line till you get to the end. And of course, the person at the end of the line is supposed to say out loud what the person next to them had whispered in their ear. And 99.9% of the time, what the person at the end of the line says is only slightly half related to what the person who started it said.
And is oftentimes not capable of being spoken out loud in many cases.
Which, of course, my thinking was is that somewhere along the line somebody wanted to be funny and changed it on purpose, which, you know, has happened in the Bible. The most important thing that we must remember, this is the most important thing we must remember when we are dealing with anything that has to do with information about God. We must know that God is real. And God is provable, the existence of God is provable, should you care to do the work to prove that God is real. And God is real and God is trustworthy. Now you may ask, well, if Abraham spoke to God face to face, and Moses spoke to God face to face, and many great men of God spoke to God face to face, some even taken into the heavens to be with God as witnesses, as elders, to observe God's activity on the earth. And yet, some of these men who spoke with God face to face had trouble trusting God, deeming God trustworthy. Then what does God look for today? What does he look for in those servants who will be the ones to ultimately and finally accomplish God's plan and his purpose to make the world a new creation? Is God trustworthy? Do we trust God enough to know that he will preserve the truth? If the truth is so important to God, and it is, then how can we say that this information that was given 2,000 years ago, that has been translated, that we cannot even find the original autographs the original manuscripts that were penned by the author, then do we determine that God is not trustworthy to preserve this information so vital to the accomplishment of his plan that we pass it off as word of mouth gossip? That when we read it, all we must always be cognizant of the fact that these words are not necessarily and probably not the teachings of the Son of God who came here to deliver them in person and then was put to death because of the words he spoke. Why would the Son of God come here to testify to the truth, to be humiliated, tortured, hung on a cross, give up his life, be resurrected, come back to life, and tell his disciples that what he wanted them to do was to take what he had commanded them, to take his words, his testimony, and teach the whole world to obey what he had taught them to obey. And yet know that 2,000 years later, his testimony to the truth would be so confounded by word of mouth transmission that the people at the end of time would have absolutely no access to the truth, try as they may to find it. God's arm is not too short to save. And yes, God does rely on people, human beings of his own creation. He relies on them, and his reliance on them is only as strong as they are. What I'm saying is, God chose David to be king. That David had some moments of indiscretion. God chose Moses to be the great leader, the one who would write the law, the words of God given to him, and he would write them down. And yet Moses had a bad temper. And one time his temper caused him to commit murder. Another time his temper caused him to disobey God's command. And various other moments of indiscretion and temper flare-ups. Yet God chose him. Why? Because he was the right person for the job at the time the job needed to be accomplished. Now, we still have a little bit of time left, and I want to bring us down to today. And I'm going to read the text that I've read many times, and I'm going to read it to open up this part of the study. You find it in Matthew chapter 17. I'm going to read two verses. Matthew 17, verse 10. And the disciples put this question to him. Why do the scribes say then that Elijah has to come first? True, he replied, Elijah is to come to see that everything is once more as it should be.
To restore all things.
What he is saying is to accomplish
restoration.
God's secret intention.
And what is the secret intention?
God's secret intention is to restore the restoration of righteousness and integrity and justice.
But why would it be called secret?
What is a secret? What makes a secret secret?
That wording, secret intention, is that a quote that's in the Jerusalem Bible, words that are
yes.
there from Revelation 10? Or
yes.
Is it, okay.
It's the mystery of God. What is a secret? It is a mystery, correct? It is a mystery to those who do not know.
Word mystery was also used in Matthew 13:10, isn't it? They're close to the
yes.
And Daniel.
So mystery to those who were not to know.
When you do not know the truth, it is a secret. The truth is a secret. When you do not know the truth is a secret.
That's Revelation 10:7.
Revelation chapter 3, I'm going to read part of I'm going to read verse 4. So Revelation chapter 3, verse 4. There are a few in Sardis, it is true, who have kept their robes from being dirtied. And they are fit to come with me, dressed in white. The white that they are dressed in is not a covering over their sin. The white that they are dressed in has come from within. Their clothing is a projection, I guess, if you will, of their integrity and righteousness and justice. And they have not dirtied this, should I say, aura? I don't know of a better, it's the aura. It's what the man and the woman in the garden had, and they lost when they dirtied it.
Contiguous verse from that is Revelation 19:7-8. Let us rejoice and be glad and give the glory to him, for the marriage of the lamb or lambkin has come, and his bride has made herself ready. It was given to her to clothe herself in fine linen, bright and clean, for the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints.
Hmm. In verse 5 of chapter 3, Revelation, the king says this: those who prove victorious will be dressed like these in white robes. I shall not blot their names out of the book of life, but acknowledge their names in the presence of my Father and his angels. Now, verse 7. Write to the angel of the church in Philadelphia and say, here is the message of the holy and faithful one who has the key of David. Now, the key of David is the key to the kingdom of God. David had the key to the kingdom of God. He just never opened the door. Why did he not open the door? Because opening the door to the kingdom needs to be, it can only be done by a qualified flesh and blood person. The door to the kingdom can only be opened by a qualified individual. Here is the message. He has the key of David so that when he opens, nobody can close. And when he closes, nobody can open. I know all about you. And now I have opened in front of you a door that nobody will be able to close. And I know that though you are not very strong, you have kept my commandments and not disowned my name. Now, right there should prove beyond any shadow of a doubt what God requires in order to walk through the door that he has opened. In Revelation chapter 12, verse 17, then the dragon was enraged with the woman and went away to make war on the rest or the last of her children. That is, all who obey God's commandments and bear witness for Jesus. Do you notice the exact connection between those two qualities and what is said here in the message to Philadelphia, verse 8 of chapter 3? I know all about you. And now I have opened in front of you a door that no one will be able to close. I know that you are not very strong. You have kept my commandments and not disowned my name. Now let me tell you that it is more than just an acknowledgement that Jesus, the Son of God, is real, that he came to this earth and that he died and that he rose again. That is, this is not acknowledging his name. To acknowledge his name means that you not only accept his words, his teachings, but you obey them. You hold to his testimony. If you do not hold to his testimony, or if you say his testimony doesn't apply to me, it only applies to the Jews. It is Paul's testimony who applies to me, because Paul got the word right from God himself that says that I am saved by grace, through faith, and not by any works that I can perform. I challenge anyone to find where the testimony of the Son of God says that. You will not find it.
In fact, what you will find is Jesus saying, it is my testimony only that will bring you truth. And you can find that in, like, in John 17. And you can, I mean, it's all over the place in
it
the eyewitness gospels.
The teaching of demons that says that we are saved by grace and not by works, not by obedience. The letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. Verse 9, Revelation chapter 3. Now I am going to make the synagogue of Satan, those who profess to be Jews but are liars, because they are no such thing. I will make them come and fall at your feet and admit that you are the people that I love. Because you have kept my commandment to endure trials, I will keep you safe in the time of trial, which is going to come for the whole world to test the people of the world. Soon. Or you could say quickly, I shall be with you. Hold firmly to what you already have, and let nobody take your prize away from you. Those who prove victorious I will make into pillars in the sanctuary of my God, and they will stay there forever. I will inscribe on them the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down from my God in heaven, and my own new name as well. If anyone has ears to hear, you see, the deaf do not hear these words. To them, these words have no real specific meaning, no application other than what they would term spiritual, yet they know nothing about spiritual. To them, spiritual is just whatever meaning is convenient for you to believe. Let him listen to what the Spirit is saying to the assemblies.
It's also what is easy to believe.
God will have a leader at the end of time, a human being who comes as an Elijah. An Elijah-type prophet. John the Baptist came in this manner, yet John the Baptist did not know who he was exemplifying and what he was preparing the world for. He thought he was preparing them for the final judgment, the harvest. But there was no grain to be harvested. The Son of God said to his disciples, "Look at the fields, they are white for harvest." The harvest is plenty, but the workers are few. When God comes to harvest, he is harvesting the whole world. The wheat he will put in his barns, the tares, the weeds, he will bundle into piles to burn. When he comes to harvest the whole world. At the time of his testimony, the harvest was almost ready. It just needed workers in the field, yet the workers in the field were keeping the harvest from being harvested. At the end, when God does come for harvest, there will be an individual whom God refers to as the faithful and wise bondservant. This faithful and wise bondservant won't so much be chosen by God, although he is chosen by God, he will choose God. He will choose to do what he is doing. And God does not come and contact him until after he has accomplished the requirements of righteousness, justice, and integrity. And this individual will be sharing. Feeding is the word that is used in Matthew chapter 24, 42 to 51. Feeding his fellow bondservants the food that was planted. The seeds are the food that was planted by the sower, capital S, who came and planted the good seed, the seed of truth. And his fellow bondservants are eating the bread made from that wheat planted by the sower. And they too will be prepared for service, just as it says in the message to those in Philadelphia, and they are also the few in Sardis who have not soiled their robes. And my friends, I do believe that we are very, very close. We are on the threshold of the time of service. Study. Look at the information and please, please, please be honest with yourself. Learn integrity, righteousness, and act with justice.
Thank you, Rick. And we encourage our listeners as part of that process to go to our Blog Talk Radio website and download some of our past programs. Yesterday I put forward three programs, one on August 13, August 20, and August 27 of 2010. The three are connected by content. We also encourage you to go to our websites, especially our WordPress website at spiritoftruthministry.net. So, on behalf of Spirit of Truth Ministry, this is Dennis Neufeld saying so long for now, and we'll see you a week from this past Friday, and we'll see you a week from today. Bye.